Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament lectionary podcast for lovers of the Hebrew Bible or just lovers everywhere.
Oh.
I'm Rachel Wren, Assistant Professor of Biblical Studies at Trinity Lutheran Seminary at Capital University.
I'm Paul Essa, a PhD student in Hebrew Bible Old Testament at Yale University.
I'm Tim McVinch. I teach Hebrew Bible at Christian Theological Seminary.
And I'm Rosie Candleful. I teach Bible in the Religion Department at Wake Forest University.
We are bringing you tips and tricks this week from the third week of Advent with the text Zephaniah 3, verses 14 to 20. Everybody's favorite prophet, right?
Cool. Right? We're like, ooh. Don't you go to like baseball games and they hold up a sign, Zephaniah 3?
Zephaniah, right, exactly. Good old Zeph. Because of that, I thought it might be helpful to start with a little bit of like historical context. Who was and when was Zephaniah? So very briefly, mostly because this is truly one of the prophets that I always have to look up to try to figure out, okay, when was this guy again? We're talking about the 640s BCE. So early Josiah reign, if that's still not ringing any bells for you, Josiah was the king who rediscovered the book of the law in the temple. And then based on the reception of that book of that law, decided to institute massive religious changes in and throughout Jerusalem and broader Judah as well. So it should be no surprise that when we're reading Zephaniah 3, we start to see this move, well, all of Zephaniah, this move towards a truer understanding of monotheism. Before this, right, you have texts that talk about the divine council or Ha Elohim, other gods, the angels, that sort of thing. We see that in the Torah. We see that in the Psalms, sometimes even in the prophets. In Zephaniah, there's only really God. There's not this sense of like God and friends or God at all. It is just Adonai. With that, then, God starts to take on some really interesting qualities because some of these other deities that were in existence that people worship start to get kind of attributed to God. So the image of God shifts a little bit. And there's one in particular that I wanted to lift up today. So I'm gonna read my way there and I'm going to read a couple verses. So it starts with a shout of joy. Sing aloud, O daughter Zion, shout, O Israel. Rejoice and exult with all your heart, O daughter Jerusalem. And then it goes on to talk in verse 16. On that day, it shall be said to Jerusalem, do not fear, O Zion. Do not let your hands grow weak. And hold that because it's one of my favorite embodied metaphors of the Bible. So we're going to come back to it. But right now, I want to talk verse 17. The Lord your God is in your midst, a warrior who gives victory. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will renew you with his love. He will exult over you with loud singing. And that is a really interesting thing to ascribe to a warrior. There's like a, you know, warrior kings are singing. I could see like victory songs, you know, that kind of makes sense. But exulting over you, renewing you with his love, there are different qualities of masculinity that are starting to develop as we have this progression in metaphors and images of God. But do y'all have any thoughts on this like image of God as warrior, but warrior love, warrior gentle kind of a thing?
I mean, the singing king reminds me of David.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that sort of mixing of ways of talking about power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think ways of talking about God, too, because we so often hear, we've talked about this on the podcast before, there's the loving God of the New Testament and the angry God of the Old Testament. And I don't think that allows for the diversity of opinion about God in both testaments.
Where do you put the singing God?
Yeah, right. The singing God right in the middle, intertestamental times. But, you know, so here we have this God who is certainly warrior, but at the same time is warrior out of love or is warrior, you know, through love. It's not, you know, not really clear. So it's almost a re-theologizing of masculinity or of power perhaps as well, which is interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting because in verse 19, it goes on, I will save the lame, gather the outcast. I'll change their shame into praise and renown in all the earth. And it's, I feel like that is also to save the lame. And to gather the outcast goes on with this idea of like a loving warrior in some sense, a noble cause.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that verse up. I wanted to talk about that, Rosie. I'm going to read it one more time, and I want you to think about the second to last line. So I will deal with all your oppressors at that time, and I will save the lame and gather the outcast, and I will change their shame into praise. What does it mean for God to change someone's shame into praise? I think that for preachers to play on that could be really interesting, just to explore what that could mean, especially because it's particular bodies that are talked about here, right? It's the lame and the outcast. So bodies or people who somehow don't fit within society, and then their shame is changed to praise. Does that mean that God changes them and changes what is wrong or broken about them, and because of that, they can turn to praise? Or does God somehow change the society around them so that the problem is actually not with them, but the problem is with us or with the communities who have pushed them to the margins? And one of the reasons I love having this in Advent is because I think about Mary, who was put in a position of shame, but God changed the shame literally into praise with the Magnificat, not by taking anything away from her situation, but by reframing it for the entire world.
Yeah. Reframing is a good word. I mean, that's kind of, I was taking a look at the Hebrew behind this and just happened to notice that the word shame is actually in the sentence pushed to the very last word.
Nice.
So like the thing that had been centered, the shame itself is pushed to the margin, even of the sentence.
Yes. So it is not the people who are pushed to the margins. It's not their bodies that are pushed to the margins. It's that social stigma, that shame that is going to be removed literally, grammatically from them. That's beautiful. I think I could hear an interesting sermon about sometimes what society identifies as shame is society's problem and not yours, that God is a warrior who fights with love to change that. And I think that could be a really beautiful, thing to play with in Advent.
You already been touching on this, but a disability perspective on this text that you've been raising up. And I don't think that gets enough airtime in our churches, thinking about the kind of ruling paradigm of disabilities are meant to be fixed or healed.
Right. Yeah. Healing, yes.
When sometimes what, as you were saying, Rachel, what needs to be changed is our perceptions about those disabilities.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that shame can be turned into praise.
Yeah.
That sounds like a great preaching angle that would really fit well with an Advent moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still want to hear what you wanted to say about do not let your hands grow weak.
Yeah, this is Rafa. It shows up in Ezra actually a couple of times. So that as the people were going to build the temple, then the enemies come to them and their hands were slackened is actually what it says. It doesn't quite work with our idiom. Like their hands were slackened is just not something that makes a whole lot of sense. But the hand symbolically was the image of power. It's the thing that you hold, but also it's the thing you hold a weapon with. So without strong grip, without strong hands, you can't do anything. So when someone has really pulled the rug out from under you, we would say, or cut you off at the knees, what it says is that they slackened the hands. I just think that's a lovely idiom because it's so foreign to our ears that it really makes us think through what has happened to them.
You remember the imagery in, I think, Exodus 17, when Israelite did just come out and, encountering like people in the wilderness and they had to fight and Moses' hands needed to go out for them to win.
Yes.
And the only way to sustain Moses' hands is that people would come out and then hold Moses' hands.
Yeah, hold his hands.
As long as your hands are held up and it's not weak.
Yeah.
Then you fight to win, right?
So the community piece too,
piece is solid.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, preachers, we hope that your hands are not being slackened as you are serving to serve up another Advent sermon.
We're working to hold your hands.
We're holding your hands as best we can. That's right. That's right. We are behind you all the way. If you're looking for something else and you didn't hear it today, check our back episodes at our website, firstreadingpodcast.com. You can reach out to us over email, firstreadingpodcast@gmail.com, over the Facebook, First Reading Podcast. And you can also like us because we like you. That's right. I got a firework. That was exciting. I hope the this come up on the recording?
I think I need to change this.
No, it's amazing. Anyway, we're done now. So I'm Rachel Wren.
I'm Paul Esma.
I think I'm Tim McNinn.
I'm pretty sure I'm Rosa Campbell. And we know that you are whoever you are. Happy preaching.
Awesome.